Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today, I'm lucky enough to be back up in the mountains in Sunspot, New Mexico, about 9,000 feet, and it's the home of, or was the home, of the National Solar Observatory. There were two of these observatories, one in Kitt's Peak in Arizona and the other here in Sunspot, New Mexico. And we're talking to the person who's been the director of the National Solar Observatory for the last 15 years. His name is Dr. Stephen Kyle. And we've had him on the program before, but this is his sort of ending of his career. He's retiring from that position, or did a year ago. And we'd like to find out, what do we know about the sun? What do we not know? And why is the National Solar Observatory leaving New Mexico? Stephen, welcome to Science Studio again.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, it's been a long time, about a year or a half, 2 years since we last spoke. And you've retired from your position as the director of the National Solar Institute. I think what the audience would like to know is, from the time you got into the game of studying the sun to today, what have we really learned? What are the new things we really understand? And what do we not know that is still very, very puzzling? So have at it.
Yeah, when I first started in solar physics, we probably did not understand how dominant a role magnetic field on the sun played over the last 30 or 40 years. There's been some big revolutions in solar physics, and the biggest, I think, was computers. So when I started...
That applies to almost all parts of science, I think,
that's
right?
That's right, yeah. So when I started, we were computing stellar atmospheres, solar atmospheres, using Runge-Kutta calculators where you had to crank them to go through. And as I got into my career, then computers became more and more dominant. The other big change, I think, that happened was going from film to CCD cameras. So suddenly, instead of studying one piece of data at a time, maybe digitizing it with some slow microphotometer or something like that, you could take thousands of images very quickly. So the biggest change, I think, in solar physics is we started looking at the dynamics of the sun. We could see how things changed as a function of time.
So, I mean, in chemistry, we call that the kinetics. I mean,
that's
just
right.
How things are progressing. And so what was the first big insight that you can recall? Once you've got to this more computing power, what was the first, oh, my God, look at that. Can you remember this?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first big insight I had was how magnetic field actually controlled the entire atmosphere from the lowest levels, what we call the photosphere, and then up through the chromosphere and into the corona. And, you know, you could see all the fine structure of magnetic field once we started getting high-resolution images of the corona, which meant we had to have X-ray imagers out in space to see these things.
So it's a combination of computers and satellite technology which really pushed the boundary.
Really helped. And then on the ground, the advent of adaptive optics. So not only could we take a long time sequence of something, we could actually resolve it and see how it evolved, only limited by whatever size telescope we happen to have. That made a big difference because then you could see the magnetic field being pushed around in the photosphere by the gas. Magnetic field in the photosphere shows up as these little bright points, and you could follow their motion, function of time. And then we started imaging higher up in the chromosphere, and we could see the result of these motions in terms of heating in the chromosphere. When I first started, people thought the chromosphere was this nice uniform layer with all the gas the same. And we quickly learned once we could image it that, no, that's not true. It's really a highly structured, quickly evolving media. And just now, in fact, that's going to be one of the biggest challenges in the next 10 years, is trying to unravel how that chromosphere, which serves as an interface between the photosphere and the corona, which then the Earth itself is buried in the corona, how that all fits together. And so when I see motions in the photosphere from a nice movie of these bright points or something, I can now look in the chromosphere and say, hey, that's creating waves, that's heating something. And those waves can travel outward on the magnetic field all the way past Earth. And they actually heat the plasma in the corona, and they actually affect the Earth's ionosphere, magnetosphere.
So these variations of the magnetic field right there in the chromosphere, as you put it, these are fluctuating and changing all the time. I mean, it's not just like on Earth we've got a North Pole that we think is relatively stable and therefore a South Pole. We know historically that they've twisted and they've inverted.
Every few million years.
Every few million years, right. So go north, young man, will be go south, young man, in another million years. But on the Sun, that movement, that transformation of magnetic fields is much quicker?
Yeah, on the Sun, of course, the Sun does look like a dipole, just like the Earth, and that dipole field flips about every 11 years. So what's north becomes south, and south becomes north.
And that's partly associated with the sunspot activity, I suppose.
Right. So sunspots are just a manifestation of the field at the surface. But the global field goes very deep in the Sun, and it interacts with both the rotation of the Sun, which, by the way, is not uniform. So parts of the Sun, as you go towards the pole, rotate slower, and the equator rotates fast. Well, what this does to magnetic field, of course, is stretch it, shear it. And as it does that, magnetic field will build up in certain areas and become buoyant because it excludes the gas, and so it's lighter than the gas, has less pressure, and floats to the surface. We see that as sunspots.
So this every 11-year flipping of the poles, tell us, how long has that been known? I know sunspot activity has been known since the Chinese probably started this.
Yeah.
But when did people associate it with a flipping of the polarity of the Sun? Who was the first person to do that?
Yeah, I don't really know. I think probably Hale was one of the first to realize that was happening back just after the turn of the century.
This was then known for about a century, let's say that, right?
Right.
So this variation of magnetic field that you see in the chromosphere, that's just been over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, we saw the structure, bright areas of the chromosphere, dark areas of the chromosphere. That kind of imaging probably goes back to the 60s when that first started. But to understand that that was magnetic field is much more recent. And to understand that those bright areas and dark areas aren't uniform, but they're really highly structured jets of gas shooting up from the photosphere and penetrating sometimes all the way up to the corona.
And who was the first person to publish that? Because in a lot of science, we understand things, but then people go back and back and back and said, that was the first paper. That was the key paper.
For the chromosphere, that's a good question. I think you know, Giovanelli down in Australia was one of the first to see the really structured part of the chromosphere, to understand that there were jets of gas, much more recent. Probably Skylab started seeing a little bit of that. And Space Lab first and then Skylab later. And then the X-ray imagers on Hinode satellite, on Solar Dynamics Observatory, have shown us that, wow, that stuff's moving all the time. It's, you know, it's never still. And if you look at these flux lines, it just looks like you've taken a broom or something and move it back and forth real fast and all the little hairs vibrate. Well, that's what the Sun looks like.
It's interesting because, you know, discoveries that are made in Australia then have people in other parts of the world looking now for things that they wouldn't have looked at before. I mean, that's for the audience. That's one of the ways science works. A discovery here leads people somewhere else to take a fresh look, a different technology.
Yeah, well, most of those Australian observations were here at Sac Peak.
Oh, they were.
So they came.
So we call them Australian results, but passing through Sunspot, New Mexico.
Right, yeah.
Because they don't have a solar observatory of sufficient resolution
They had a very nice radio observatory, but it didn't have high resolution on the Sun.
All right. So, in fact, then, we call this the National Solar Observatory, and it's in Sunspot, New Mexico. But, in fact, it's used by groups all over the world.
Right. And it's open to anybody that wishes to apply for time. They have to write a proposal and explain what they're going to do. We tell them if it's feasible.
Who judges these? You send it out for
referees
around the world?
Yeah, we have a telescope allocation committee that looks at the scientific merit, and then the observing staff looks at the technical feasibility, and then we rank them, and take the, you know, depending on how many have applied that given quarter, we take the top proposals.
And so approximately at any given moment, how many foreign observers are here physically, or do they do it remotely?
No, usually people come here. We've tried some remote observations the last couple of years in anticipation of our new telescope, which will be mostly remote. So the idea there is somebody writes a proposal, we put it in a queue and execute it when the conditions are what they wanted, whether it's good seeing or less activity on the sun, whatever it is, and then we execute the queue. But normally the PI comes here, runs his experiment. Because solar, we always keep looking at the same star.
Right.
And to make progress, you need a new instrument. And so most people that come here are instrumentalists, and they work on designing a new instrument so they can make a unique observation that no one's made before.
So you talk about a new telescope, a new instrument. What are you referring to, right here in Sunspot, or is this part of the reorganization of the NSO?
Yeah, no, this is part of the reorganization. So we wanted to build a 4-meter telescope, and after many years, we got the funding for it. Before we decided where to put it, we did a very extensive site survey. So we put telescopes at 6 sites around the world, looking for the best site. Actually, we started with 72 sites, and we eliminated most of them on weather.
Now tell me, did you have to go and visit all these sites?
Yeah, I did.
What a sinecure.
Anyway, so after the survey, we found that for what we want to do with the telescope, which is both high resolution and looking into the corona, Haleakala on the Isle of Maui in Hawaii had the best conditions. So the new telescope is being built there. If you go to our website, nso.edu, and click on DKIST, D-K-I-S-T, the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope.
Uh-huh. Named after the senator.
Named after the senator. Right. You can see it being constructed.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Steve Kyle, who was the former director of the National Solar Observatory, stationed here in beautiful Sunspot, New Mexico at 9,000 feet. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. As many as 20% of us are anxious about seeing the dentist.
I don't relish it either, but sometimes you have to. So I'm usually delighted to see research that can make a dental visit less stressful.
In a recent study, the dental drill is replaced with a laser light to fix cavities. It shines a low-powered laser onto damaged teeth to stimulate the regrowth of dentin.
The laser light works by stimulating stem cells already in the teeth. This approach repairs damage from within, possibly one day eliminating the need for fillings altogether.
In our teeth are 4 different tissues: enamel, dentin, and cementum, which are all harder than bone, while dental pulp is the innermost layer. It's a soft tissue where stem cells reside.
Among the strengths of this therapy is that stem cells don't need to be removed from the body, grown in the lab, then reimplanted. Nor do they require growth factors, which risks uncontrolled growth.
Using mice, researchers drilled holes in their dentin to simulate tooth damage. Next, they shone a non-ionizing or low-powered laser on the damaged area and the pulp beneath. They then capped the damaged teeth.
With just a single 5-minute treatment, the mice had new dentin form in the damaged area in 12 weeks. Similar results were seen in cultured human dental stem cells.
The laser seems to create micro-injuries that stimulate the release of latent growth factors such as TGF-beta-1. The growth molecules then activate stem cells, promoting tissue generation and restoring the damaged dentin.
The next step is human clinical trials, and if successful, researchers are looking at regeneration of other tissues using the same approach.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Steve Kyle from the National Solar Observatory, ex-director, reminiscing and telling us what the big discoveries have been on his watch, if you like, at the NSO. So you're going to have a new NSO with this new telescope, 4-meter telescope in Maui, very nice place. Are you not somewhat jealous about not being associated with it and going spending a few years on Maui?
You know, that would be very enjoyable. I've actually spent a few years on Maui, mostly in courthouses.
That's an interesting story, I hope, right?
Lots of travel to Maui, just getting permission to build the telescope.
No criminal activity.
No criminal activity. Yeah, I think I'll miss it. In fact, I still plan to be one of the first users of the new telescope.
Tell us, that's interesting. What is the particular project that you have in mind to use?
I would really like to look into the lanes between these bright granules in the photosphere. And we all do a lot of modeling, and current models, magnetohydrodynamic models of MHD, if you like, show that these things, these dark lanes, house most of the magnetic field. And that
so they encapsulate the field.
Yeah, and in the dark lanes, there's these very, very strong downflows, and these downflows are twisting.
What do you mean by downflow?
So the gas is shooting down away, you know, into the sun.
Into the sun.
Into the sun. Right. So between the lanes, you have these bright areas that are gas rising, and then what really drives it, though, is the gas falling down, and it falls down at supersonic velocities, and it's dragging magnetic field and twisting the magnetic field. And, of course, this magnetic field goes out of the sun and connects elsewhere in the sun, forms the corona and chromosphere as it does so. And it would really be fun to measure the field in these downflows, which we can't do right now because our resolution is not good enough. So the 4-meter telescope will, for the first time, let us actually measure that accurately enough to do physics.
Now, as the former director, did you have to put a proposal and send it out to reviews for people to say, this is good, or, Steve doesn't know what he's talking about. He just wants to visit after retirement.
Well, you have to remember, so the telescope comes online in 2019. So I will definitely write a proposal, submit it from my fishing lodge, and hopefully get it approved and be one of the first observers at the new telescope.
You cannot talk about the sun these days without people finally coming to discuss climate, right? There's this whole business of global warming. You know, there are very vociferous people out there that make all sorts of claims and judgments. And then there's a school of thought that says, well, we really don't know enough about the energy arriving on Earth from the sun, and therefore we should be a little jaundiced perhaps about saying that it's due to human activity, whether it's CO2 or overpopulation. What's your sort of general feeling? Do we really know well the amount of energy arriving from the sun, and we've got a historical platform to sit and say, no, there's something else other than sun energy that's causing global warming?
Yeah. Well, there's something we call the solar constant, which is the amount of energy that strikes the outer atmosphere. And that's been pretty steady. I mean, it fluctuates over 11 years, but by less than 1%. Okay, so the effect of that percent is pretty weak. And it hasn't changed much since we started doing detailed observations of the sun and actually had satellites in space that could measure the total output of the sun. But what does change a lot on the sun is the high energy output, X-rays, gamma rays, ultraviolet. That changes dramatically over 11 years. And it has a big effect on the outer atmosphere of the Earth. It controls the ozone layer, for example, how high it is, controls how high the ionosphere is, and it also controls really high altitude cloudiness, which affects the albedo of the Earth.
The reflection of energy.
Yeah.
Right.
Energy back out. So, yeah, the sun can have a big effect. So if you have a weak activity cycle with very little high energy emission, that'll have an effect on the Earth. If you have a big cycle with lots of high energy emission, that pushes the Earth's atmosphere down a bit.
But that's a sort of an 11-year cycle.
That's an 11-year cycle.
That's not over centuries of variation.
That's right. Yeah, so it's very difficult to account for current global warming with just the solar output. It doesn't change enough, you know, to give the effects we're seeing.
And yet people don't still agree to that. I mean, you see so many opinions out there.
Yeah, I think most solar astronomers right. agree to that.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's enough.
And most climate scientists say the sun, nah. I couldn't do anything. So I think it's the non-scientific people that say, oh, yeah, it must be the sun.
Okay, well, that settles that argument from Steve Kyle, director, ex-director of the National Solar Observatory.
In terms of how the sun influences the Earth, there's other effects that are much more pronounced. Solar activity, for example, energetic particles due to a flare on the sun certainly impact spacecraft. Men in space are actually exposed to radiation due to the sun. Changes in the height of the atmosphere change GPS accuracy changes. So there's a lot of effects. And how they come
they're
about...
They're subtle effects? Or are they? I mean, if I'm driving from Houston to Maine, and my GPS, am I going to be off very much during one of these events? Or am I going to get closed out completely?
No, it probably won't affect you much there, but it has knocked out communications.
Right.
Okay. Where the GPS becomes important, say you're a pilot or a commander of a military unit and you're relying on precise coordinates to right. do something, then having GPS effective becomes very critical. So it depends on what you're doing.
But are there examples where solar flares and...
A lot of examples. So there's a lot of traffic along polar routes, especially from the East Coast to Asia. Those planes all divert if there's a major flare, and they go to lower latitudes. And the cost to the airlines is substantial. You know, a diversion like that can cost you $100,000 worth of fuel easily. So... there's people very interested. There's a meeting every year in Boulder on space weather effects, and a lot of airlines show up to that meeting. A lot of Air Force people show up to the meeting. So the effects can be substantial.
Why is it more pronounced at the polar region?
So where the energetic particles come is kind of an interesting story in itself. So when there's mass or magnetic field ejected from the sun and it comes towards the Earth, the solar wind causes the Earth's magnetic tail to stream out behind it. Well, where the particles come from is from that tail. So you disturb the field, it shakes the tail, and in comes the particles. And those fields go right to the poles.
You know, okay, so if you really want to travel safely, just stick around the equatorial regions.
Yeah. So what interests me as a solar physicist, of course, what causes those events. We don't know right now what the mechanisms of flare are. So a flare accelerates all these particles. We don't know how it does that. We think it's some kind of magnetic recombination where I force opposite field lines together and suddenly they go into a lower energy state and I push all this gas out. But we don't have the smoking gun yet for that.
So it seems that, okay, you're retiring this year. Last year you retired as director, and now you're retiring completely from the National Solar Observatory. But you're going to maintain a very active inquiry into what's going on. So this is retirement nirvana, in a sense. You have no responsibilities as director,
right.
But you can still use all your knowledge and the instrumentation that is being devised.
That's right, and I'll probably accept an emeritus position, keep my computer, and continue to work on some of the data I've taken over the years, trying to understand that.
And you're going to do all this from Colorado?
Right,
You were telling me that, because I was just, for the audience, I just visited Steve's house here on the top of the Sacramento Mountains, and he looks over this White Sands area. It's just a magnificent view, and I was saying how much you're going to miss it. And his response was, tell me again.
Yeah, well, we're moving up to Pagosa Springs, and our house sits on a little lake looking straight at the San Juan Mountains. So it will be very nice, I think. Good place to do solar research.
Absolutely. And it's not in your dotage. It's in, well, you're still very active and you've seen the history of solar studies for, let's say, 40 years or period of time as a solar physicist, as you put it. And you've suggested where new lines of research are going to go. What do you think is going to be a really big eureka moment?
Yeah, I anticipate that we will combine many different sources of data, satellite, ground-based data. Something I failed to mention is part of the National Solar Observatory is a network of telescopes that watch the sun's oscillations. And as the sun oscillates, we can do seismology and look below the surface. And we're starting now to do high-resolution seismology, just on Earth, where you can pinpoint where an earthquake occurred. Mm-hmm. We're starting to pinpoint where magnetic field is below the surface. And so I think the biggest breakthrough in the future is going to be combining that with what's happening at the surface. And we'll be able to draw a picture of where the activity is coming from, see it before it actually gets to the surface where it's going to explode, and follow it as a function all the way up through the chromosphere and all the way out to the Earth.
So you think you're going to be able to do that before they can do it on Earth for earthquakes, because that's the holy grail.
That's
earthquake
right.
Prediction would be Nobel Prize winning, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think putting it all together into a single picture. Of course, the modelers need bigger, faster computers to model that whole system.
Right.
But us observers, we can start to see major parts of it, and we can speculate how it all fits together.
Well, that's what science is, isn't it? Modeling, right. Looking at experiment, getting data, yeah. Speculating again, and going there and forth, backwards and forwards.
You know, for a long time, modelers have led the field. They'll tell us a prediction, and we'll go out and try to see it. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But I think with a new telescope and the new techniques for seismology, we should be able to get ahead of the modelers for a while.
So, I mean, that brings us back to the end, in a sense, of Sunspot. The new telescopes are going to be in Maui, and I think there's another one somewhere, too?
No, the NSO will have one large telescope in Maui. We'll still have our network of telescopes, and we're looking at ways of improving that network.
So here in Sunspot, this will still be part of the observatory network, or is there what's going to happen here?
What we hope for Sunspot, so the National Science Foundation plans to stop funding Sunspot at the end of 2017. We're looking for customers or users that would take over operation of the observatory, and then university groups, even NSO, could lease back the telescope as needed for instrument development, graduate student training, things like that.
Steve Kyle, ex-director of the National Solar Observatory here in Sunspot, New Mexico. Thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. Thank you also for your career because, people who do science, we do it in very seclusion quite often, right? And you go to a bar, I don't know if you go to bars, but say, what do you do? And you say, I'm a chemist or I'm a solar physicist. And then they move away. But thank you very much for what you've done and great pleasure.
Thank you, Keith. Appreciate it.
And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez, as usual, for putting this together in a form that's riveting. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Medical Center of the Americas Foundation is organizing Dynamica Expo. It is El Paso's largest healthcare innovation conference taking place November 14th and 15th. Continuing education units will be offered. Register at dynamicaexpo.org. Support for Synapse and for Dynamica Expo comes from the Sierra Providence Health Network.